This week we closed the Chumash of Bamidbar. And when I say we, I mean all of us. Finally, the Jewish world is in sync again. We have the one parasha, Chutzlaretz have the two, and we are reunited. And the parasha of Maaseh, of course, begins with a listing of the journeys of Bnei Yisrael, the famous Membeis Masos, the 42 journeys, and the pasuk reads, Perek Lamed Gimel Pasuk Aleph, Eile Maaseh Bnei Yisrael. These are the journeys of Bnei Yisrael, and Moshe writes them down. Pasuk Beis, Vayichtov Moshe es Motzo Ehem Lamaseh Ehem Al Pi Hashem, Ve'eile Maaseh Ehem Lamotzo Ehem. So Moshe writes Motzo Ehem Lamaseh Ehem, and these are their Maaseihem leMotzaeihem. What's Motzaeihem? What's Maaseihem? Well, Maaseis are journeys. And I think the simplest translation of the word Motzaeihem is points of departure, from the word Motza, Yotze, from where they left. But then Maaseihem would be where they arrived. Whatever the translation of the word Motzaeihem means, we cannot help but notice that in the two phrases of the pasuk, it has flipped them around. Whereby the first phrase describes motza ehem lemasa ehem, the motza before the masa, and then the concludes the eile mas ehem lemotza ehem. Concludes by putting the masa before the motza. So the question, of course, is which is it? Which comes first, masa or motza? Well, the answer, as far as the pasuk is concerned, is yes, but we need to understand how this works. And I would like to present a fascinating explanation of this pasuk and preface by referring to an episode that is recorded in the Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Brachos. This is Daf Gimel Amud Aleph. Amar Rabbi Yossi recounts, Pam achas hayisi mahalech baderech. I was once going along the way, and came time for davening. V'nichnasti l'churva achas mi'churvos Yerushalayim, and I entered one of the ruins of Yerushalayim for privacy, to collect my thoughts, to focus. Ba Elio zachur latov. Along came Elio Anavi, zachur latov. V'shamar li ala Pesach. And he watched for me, watched out for me on the Pesach. And v'shamarli also means that he waited for me, like v'aviv shamaras hadavar. He waited for me. Ad shesiyamti tfilasi. I was davening. Elio wanted to talk to me, so he waited. Very nice. Af megazot, as they say. But it's also especially interesting because Elio HaNavi, who has an unlimited amount of time available, clearly is capable of timing things for when Rabbi Yossi finishes. But he came early in order to wait. Okay. I don't know if Rabbi Yossi was aware of this while he was davening, but in any case, L'acha sheziyamti tfilasi, after I finished davening, Amarli, he said to me, Shalom Alecha Rebbe. He gave me a nice bechovet gebrocha, shalom alecha Rebbe. Amarti lo shalom alecha Rebbe Umori. I said to him, shalom alecha Rebbe Umori. The Ben Yehoyada says, Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, you see from here that if someone gives you shalom, so when you return shalom, you should actually return more than they gave you. So each one did something. The one person went first, which is very nice. So if you came second, so at least give him more. And people do that. I think maybe even unconsciously, or maybe it's because of this. One person says shalom, the other person will say shalom ubracha, or shalom shalom. And it's you see the sources in this story. If someone ever says to you shalom alecha Rebbe, now you know to say shalom alecha Rebbe Umari. Va'amarli, he then said to me, Bini. I went from being his Rebbe to his son very quickly. Mipnei manichnasa lechurva zu. Why do you go into the churva? We shouldn't really enter a churva. Amarti lo lispalo. I said I wanted to daven. V'amarli haya lecha lehispalo baderach. You should have davened on the road. You shouldn't have gone into a churva. As the Gemara proceeds to outline, for a number of reasons, it's not a good idea. It's not recommended to go into a churva for safety and so on and so forth. So you should have davened on the road. Amatilo, misyari hayisa shema yafsikuni over drachim. If I'm on the road, people could disturb me. I didn't want anyone to disturb my davening. Amarli, he said, you still should have davened on the road. Hayalacha lehispalel tefillah kitzara. You should have had an abbreviated tefillah, whatever that abbreviated tefillah is. Better to have davened shorter on the road than to have gone to a churva. And then Rabbi Yossi proceeds to list off the things that he learned from Eliyahu HaNavi. Not to go into a churva, should daven tefillah kitzara, if one's on the road, v'chulei, so on and so forth. And the Gemara ensues, but we've quoted the section that relates to our discussion. Because the Ben Yehoyada raises a very interesting question. You see sometimes what comes out from a shift in phraseology, a nuance, a turn of phrase. You see, there are two travelers mentioned in this story, says Ben Yehoyada. Firstly, is Rabbi Yossi. He says he was once traveling along the way. Who are the other travelers? The travelers who he was fearful that they would disturb him. So in terms of elements in the story, there's two travelers. He was traveling. He didn't want other travelers to disturb him. But it's interesting that the designation and the term that is used for those travelers is not the same. How so? Because Rabbi Yossi begins by saying, Pam achas hayisi mehalech baderech. I was going along the way. Apparently, the way to refer to someone who's traveling is mehalech baderech, holchei drachim, or mehalchei drachim. But when he says to Eliyahu HaNavi, I was afraid that people would disturb my davening, he says, misyare hayisi, I was afraid shemiyafsikuni ovrei drachim, people that are passers-by. But isn't it true that anyone who's walking on the way is passing by? So why is it that he is referred to as mehalech baderech, but the people he was afraid would disturb him are called ovrei drachim? And the Ben Yehoyada says a wonderful insight. There's actually two ways to travel. There's two perspectives that a person can have on the path that they are taking, especially as sometimes the journey doesn't always go according to plan. There could be a delay or a diversion or things happen. And there are two perspectives, two approaches to such things, to journeys. For some people, when they're on the derech, when they're journeying, they're not really anywhere, because the only places that really register as worthy of the name is where they came from and where they're going to. And in between, they're in transit, but it's of no meaning. And the sooner it's what they call in the halachas of Shabbos, melacha sheina tzricha legufa. If only I didn't have to be on the journey, if only I was already there, all the better. There's no need to tarry, but it's time that has no real meaning. I know where I need to be. I'm not there at the moment, which means I'm nowhere in particular. There are other people who understand that wherever you are, you're somewhere. You're not always in A. You're not always in B. Sometimes you're between A and B. But between A and B is also a place. And as surely as there is what to do and a way to behave and things to learn from where you came from and from where you're going to, there's often a reason why you're where you are in between.
A.A. Milne. That's what you sound like.
Okay. These two approaches are reflected in the two terms mehalchei drachim and ovrei drachim. Mehalchei drachim means even when they're on the derech, they're still going. It's a mahalach, it's a process, and they're still processing. And that's why Rabbi Yossi, who was one such person, and look what happened to him on the way, he met Eliyahu HaNavi. And he has this perspective, and therefore, whenever he journeys, he's always mahalach baderech. I have a mahalach when I'm home, a mahalach when I'm out, and I'm a mahalach when I'm in between, mahalach badrachim. But there are other types of people, for them the derech is just in the way. And if it could only, the sooner the better, and they close up because nothing's happening until they get to where they feel they need to be. Those people are called ovrei drachim. They just pass through the derech. And what the interesting point is, Rabbi Yossi says, I went into the churva because I didn't want to be disturbed. Let's ask the shaila, who's going to disturb you? You're a Biosi, you're davening. Someone's going to interrupt you? What type of person would do that? The answer is an over derech would do that. A person who doesn't know why he's there and wants to move on as quickly as possible, and he will do whatever it takes in order to do that, to achieve that, including interrupting someone who's davening, because I need to be somewhere and this person can help me and I'm sorry that he's davening, but my needs must. A mahalech derech would never interrupt someone who's davening, because his whole perspective is, if I'm here for a reason. And if someone's davening, so then there's a reason why I need here to be a little bit more. And they wait for him to finish davening. And thus you see, in this turn of phrase, says Ben Yehoyada, what type of person would be courteous and gracious in the face of a bit of a holdup that's beyond their control, someone who realizes maybe they just need to be there a little bit more. That's called mahalech derech, but an over derech would interrupt. So says Ben Yehoyada, and of course for people that are mahalchei drachim, there's a great deal to ponder here, and sometimes there's a great amount of time on the derech in which to ponder it. How does this relate to the beginning of Parshas Maaseh? Says one of the great mefarshim of the 1800s, Rabbi Yehuda Asad. Let's come back to our psukim. The Jewish people were wandering, and every place they went, something happened. The things that happened in their various journeyings, they are the motzo'ehim. They're what came out of the journey. In other words, maaseihim is the journey itself. But every journey had something, had an outcome, an event, an episode, a lesson. And therefore, when Moshe writes their journeyings, when he chronicles their journeyings, so the pasuk begins by saying, "Vayichtov Moshe es motzaeim lemasaehem." The question is, which accrues to what? Which pertains to what? Which is an outcome of what? The common understanding is that the things that you learned are a product of the places that you went, and that's called motzaeim. Lemasaehem. They're the outcomes, they belong to the journey. So we were in a certain place and a certain outcome happened. Because we were there, that's why we learned this thing or this episode happened. But motzaehem lemasaehem al pi Hashem. The places that they were to journey is al pi Hashem. That means that the causational relationship between the lessons learned, the things experienced, and the places they went is actually reversed. The outcomes were not a function of the places they went. The places they went were a function of the things that they needed to learn there. And that's why the pasuk concludes, if it's Api Hashem, it's not called Motzaim LaMaseim. It's called Maseihem LaMotzaehem. The places that you go, they're a function of what it is that you need to learn or experience at that time. So it's interesting to see the two perspectives of Mahalchei Drachim and Ovrei Drachim are actually compacted in the order of the terms of the motza and of the masa. Now, one of the as we go through the masaos here, as the pasuk details them and describes them, it has us go through the yamsuf that happens at a certain point, and that is. In the early psukim, we'll get to them in just a moment. I'd like to preface by referring to a statement in the Gemara. It's in Maseches Arachin in Daf Tesvav, which I think was recently in the Daf Yomi. Pirkei Avos tells us in the fifth perek that the Jewish people tested HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, 10 times. Asara Nisyonos Nisu Avoseinu Es HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bamidbar. There's a pasuk to that effect. Vayinasu Osi Ze Eser Pa'amim. So the Mishnah gives us the list, 10, or more correctly, the number, 10. But the Gemara in Erechin and Daf Tesvav, it breaks it down, it itemizes them. Where did they happen? And the Gemara says, two of them happened by the Yamsuf. Once before they went in, and once when they came out. Achas biyiriyosam, the achas ba'aliyosam. And now what are the tests? The tests are where we doubt HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Well, as we know, the test going in is explicit in the pasuk. Because when we saw Mitzrayim is behind us and the sea is in front of us, Amiblien kavorim b'mitzrayim, not enough graves in Egypt, that's why we're here, we were brought here to die. That lack of emunah, of course, it was a very difficult situation, is called one of the tests. But what's the test after we came out of the Yamsuf? I mean, you don't see it in the Pasuk. In the Pasuk, all you see is Az Yashir. Where was the test afterwards? Says the Gemara, amazingly, when the Jewish people came out of the Yamsuf, they still were worried about the Egyptians because they said, okay, we're here, they must be somewhere nearby, and we're not out of the woods. They didn't realize the Mitzrayim had drowned. And pending realizing that seeing the Mitzrayim, until it says, Vayar Yisrael, that's Mitzrayim, Mesas Vasayam, when they saw it, they'd actually drowned, then finally they realized they were out of trouble. But before that, they were convinced or concerned that, okay, so we went in, we came out, we're outside the Yamsuf, but Egypt has got to be somewhere nearby. That was the second test, Ba'aliyasa. And Tosfos has to get involved here, because this second test just does not, it seems to defy comprehension, that doubt, that worry, as if to say, on the way in, it's not correct for them to have reacted that way, but you can understand why they did. It makes sense. Barring a miracle, they are in deep trouble. There's the sea on one side, the Egyptians on the other side, and as far as they're concerned, they're done for. It wasn't the right reaction, but you can understand why they would think that. But how is it even possible to understand how they could countenance the idea that having gone through the Yam Suf, the Mitzrayim are still around? I mean, they came with you. You think HaKadosh Baruch Hu left the Yam Suf open for them as well? The whole miracle was for nothing? Just to relocate everyone so they could just capture you on the other side? I mean, that's not fear. That's paranoia. So how can we understand such a thing? What? I mean, you need an imagination to come up with something like that. But the truth is that this brings us to a very interesting discussion with regards to Kriyas Yamsuf. And it's something that perhaps of which we are aware, but to see how it comes out from the Makoros. I think any depiction of Kriyas Yamsuf, if you break it down to its most basic component parts, has the Jewish people, well, everyone on one side, and then the sea splits, and only one side makes it through to the other side. And that's the Jewish people, and the Mitzrayim get drowned in the middle. It's not so simple, however. There are a number of Rishonim who are of the understanding that Kriyas Yamsuf did not take the event of passing through the Yamsuf, but rather we entered the Yamsuf, followed by the Egyptians, but actually then wheeled round and came out of the Yamsuf on the same side that we entered, but did not traverse it all the way through. This is the opinion of the Rambam in his commentary on Pirkei Avos. If you ever look at the Rambam's Perush there, there's actually a picture. It looks like a rainbow, but it's actually his depiction of Kriyas Yamsuf, because there everyone is just wheeling around. And the Ibn Ezra likewise is of this opinion. And in fact, it is stated explicitly in the Medrash. And the Medrash Lekach Tov states they only needed to enter the Yamsuf enough to draw the Egyptians in so that they could come out and the Egyptians would stay inside. But it's all happening on the same side. And the reason why I mention it within the context of Parshas Maaseh is because the most compelling evidence for this idea in terms of Psukim in the Chumash comes from Parshas Maaseh, not from Parshas Vayishlach, interestingly. How so? Because if we have a look in Pasuk Vav of the Perek Lamed Gimel, it says Vayisumi Sukkos. Okay, that's an interesting thing in itself. We on the first day of Pesach, we're already in Sukkos. Okay, Vayachanu be'esam, and then they camped in Esam, Asher b'Ktzeh HaMidbar. Okay, so the last point here in Pasuk Vav, the Jewish people are in a place called Esam. Now, Pasuk Ches, Vayisumi Piachiros, which was a sub section there, Vayavu b'soch hayam hamidbar, and they went through the sea. or in the middle of the sea, more correctly, towards the desert. Vayelchu derech shloshis yomim b'midbar Esam, and they yet journeyed for 3 days in the wilderness of Esam. Says the Radak in his Perush to Tehillim, Perek Kuf Lamed Vav, Pasuk Vav has told us that prior to entering the Yamsuf, they were in the wilderness of Esam. Having gone through the Yamsuf and come out again, they're still in Midbar Esam. That means they're still on the same side. The assumption is that Midbar Esam, it does not straddle the Yamsuf, which is entirely reasonable. I mean, a sea is a marker. And therefore, says Radak, we see from here that, like the Rambam is saying, like the Ibn Ezra is saying, that they came out the same side. They went in, entered Midbar Esam, exit Midbar Esam. And as far as the Tosfos is concerned, this is really what the Gemara is saying. Once we understand that they came out on the same side, we can begin to understand the fear of the Jewish people that even having exited the Yamsuf, they were still going to be pursued by the Egyptians. It's not as we originally thought, that they went from one side to the other and they thought that it's just as the Egyptians, just as they passed through, the Egyptians passed through and we're going to pursue them. Rather, they realized that they'd come out the same side they're on. And moreover, for the life of them, they could not have imagined that the Egyptians had entered into the Yamsuf. And this actually is one of the big puzzles of Kriyas Yamsuf. Why did the Egyptians go in the first place? I mean, you have to figure, with all due respect to self-esteem, which the Egyptians had at least once upon a time in large measure, but after a year of the plagues, and you pursue the Jewish people, and the Red Sea miraculously splits open, you've got to know that it's not for you. And you have to realize that by now. You are staking your life on the notion that Hashem has left it open for them. If surely he's going to keep it open for us so we can continue to pursue them, that's a slightly wrong turn to have taken in terms of decision making. And that becomes the question. Why did the Egyptians follow them into the Yamsuf? The simple reason is they didn't know where they were going. You know, it was pitch dark, etc., but the Jewish people have no notion of what's happening behind them, which means the last thing they expected is that the Egyptians would follow them in. But if they, as far as they're concerned, the Egyptians would have stayed there on the banks while they went through, but they came out the same side that they went in, that's why they said, so they're still going to pursue us because we've gone through but come out the same side. Presumably they haven't gone through in the first place, so we're still just back where we started. Until they realized, and the biggest chiddush of Kriyas Yamsuf for the Jewish people was when at the point where they saw the Egyptians had actually followed them in and had drowned there at the Yamsuf, and finally that allayed their fears. But this is a very interesting, you see how from many different vantage points and angles, from the Psukim and from the Gemara and from the Medrash, etc., and how Parshas Maaseh, although it is in principle a recap, so to speak, it continues to shed light on the events, sometimes adding in details for us that were not there even in Parshas B'Shalach, which is a much more lengthy description. So, having discussed some of the Masa'os, I would like to discuss mention for a few moments an idea. It emerges from this week's Parsha, and it emerges through a Maisa that happened. The Brisker Rav, Rav Velvo Soloveitchik, in his later years, or whenever it was, and he was already quite frail, so that the minyan on Shabbos morning was in his house. And in fact, at a certain point, it was hard for him even to get out of bed. He wasn't even in the room where everyone else was, but the door was open, and he was following, etc. And the following Maisa happens in Parshas Maaseh, Shabbos Parshas Maaseh, where the Baal Kori is reading, and it's Shlishi. And someone comes in and taps him on the shoulder and said, the Rav said you need to go back. You made a mistake. Now that's, of course, not a pleasant feeling. Most of the discussions that concern Shlishi in Shuls are not about what the Baal Kori said. It's more about who got Shlishi in the first place. But where's the mistake? Especially as... it's places largely. I mean, where can the mistake be? So he went into, either they finished the Aliyah or they did whatever they needed to do. He went to the Briska Rav and asked, where was my mistake? The Briska Rav said, if you look in Perek Lamed Dalet, in Pasuk, Dalet, Perek Lamed Dalet, Pasuk Dalet. And these are the Gevulos, and of course there's much more in terms of the Gevulos themselves to discuss that we'll need to for another time. We are literally focusing on one word here. What does the Pasuk say? So one of the critical points is a place called Tzin, Midbar Tzin, which is like there near Edom. And Pasuk Dalet reads, V'nasav lachem ha-gevul minegev, from the south, l'malei akrabim, v'avar tzina, v'ayutotov minegev l'kadesh barnea, etc. and so forth. Says the Briska Rav, you misread. He said, that's what I read. And the Rav said, no. You read as follows. And Pasuk Dalet again from the beginning. V'nasav lachem ha-gevul minegev l'malei akrabim, v'avar tzina. You read the word Sina, but the word is Sina. And should we ask, well, what difference does that make? I mean, Sina and Sina, it's the same, isn't it? I mean, one's called Milara, one's called Mila'el, the later syllable, the earlier syllable, but does it make a difference? Says the Briska Rav, it changes the meaning of the word completely. How so? So the Rav said, Sina relates to the place called Tzin. The place is Tzin. And Tzina, the hey at the end, means towards Tzin, like Mitzrayim or so on and so forth. And therefore, the emphasis needs to be on the first syllable. Tzina means towards Tzin, and that's where the border goes, by Tzin. You read the word Tzina. So, does that mean something different? It does, says the Briska Rav. Tzina is a shield. As we say in Tehillim, Tzina v'socheira amito, in Yoshe b'seisa elyo. Ve'vrosa yasechla, Tzina v'socheira amito. Magen v'tzina. Tzina is a shield. So for you, the border went by a shield. What's amazing about this is the Briska Rav did not have enough koch to get out of bed. The monitoring of the Kriya Satora where the emphasis on the word was Tzina and Tzina are two completely different words. And what's very interesting is this is something that applies in a number of occasions. I'll just give one or two more examples. I don't like to talk too much about matters of grammar. It often enters a shaila of Tsar Bale Chaim. But you see, especially as very often it's just a matter of habituation or nohag, the way which emphasis people stress. And sometimes you never know that it makes a difference. In Shmona Esrei, for example, and the bracha of Chonin Hadas, so Ashkenazim say Chonin Medcha Deya Bina V'Haskel, Deya Bina V'Haskel. That's a good from pronunciation, intonation. Deya Bina V'Haskel. In strict terms, it is a mispronunciation. And the reason is as follows. The word is bina. Bina is a concept, understanding. Bina. Is bina any different? It is. Bina is a request to be understood. For example, we say in the Slichos, Amareinu hazina Hashem, bina hagigenu. Give ear to our words and give understanding to our thoughts, to our inner thoughts. Bina, with the emphasis on the earlier syllable, with stress there, is a request. Bina is a concept. It can change the meaning. Very interesting. Sometimes the Shliach Tzibur might be even a shlemazel there and finally say, Bina hagigeinu, and he should have been saying that Shmona Esrei the whole year round. Okay. Just one final example for us, but again, when you look around, you see, and I mentioned it, I think it's a fascinating idea. Lahavdil, I don't know if there's another language that has this, whereby the very same syllables are there, but just where you put the stress changes the word completely. In Lachadodi, we say, Yisori, Yisori, Kiva, Orech, Kumi, Ori. Now, the other way to pronounce the word is kumi ori. Ori and ori are not the same word. The yud has a completely different function there. Because if it's ori, that yud is the first person possessive. My light, or sheli, ori. Like the David Hashem, ori v'yishi. But that's not what we're saying. We're not saying ori, we're not talking about my light. You're talking to Yerushalayim. It's in the feminine. When you give a command to the feminine form, second person, there's a yud there. Kumi, that's why we say, kumi tse'i. And that's what ori is. But that's why it's ori. Ori, kumi, ori means rise and shine. Rise and radiate. And that's clearly what it means. It's for evidence from the Navi and Yeshaya, from the Haftarah. It's kumi ori, kiva orech. And that's a particularly interesting example because I think there the question as to where you put the stress, which syllable you stress, is not so much a question of, not only a question of how you grew up and where you live, but it might also depend on what tune they're singing for Luchadodi. Because depending on whether it works out, so then it's either ori or ori, but to be aware that those are two very different words, right? Nature shouldn't be made to imitate art here. So this is, again, it began with tzina, tzina and tzina, bina and bina, ori and ori. Just a short point of diktuk and lashon hakodesh. I have to say diktuk doesn't have the best mazel. In fact, the word diktuk itself is actually a mispronunciation because it's really diktuk, milara, but in any case, that's enough on that subject for now. So I'd like to move from here to the final pasuk of the parsha. Eile hamitzvos, the very end, perik lamed vav pasuk yud gimel, the final pasuk of the sefer. You may experience a Pavlovian impulse to stand up, but you may remain seated. Eile hamitzvos v'mishpatim. These are the mitzvahs, the mishpatim, asher tziva Hashem biyad Moshe al b'nei Yisrael, that Hashem commanded through Moshe b'nei Yisrael, ba'avros mav, ayardein yirecha. Okay, a pasuk of summation. Now, there is a well-known drasha, quoted in the Gemara in a number of places, on the words, Eile hamitzvos. And this is a Gemara in Megillah and Daf Gimel and Shabbos Kuf Gimel and tomorrow also in Tet Zayin, maybe even also one or two other places. The exposition is quite well known. Eile hamitzvos, what is the meaning? Says the Gemara. Mikan she'ein hanavi rashai lechadesh davar me'ata. From this point onwards, no prophet can introduce any more halachas d'oraisa. That's it. Eila mitzvahs. That's it. Ein navi rashi lechadesh davar me'ata. There can be no chidushim, new mitzvahs from any Novi post Moshe Rabbeinu, new mitzvahs of the Torah, that means to say. Interestingly, this is a parallel, one could almost say like a sister drasha, to the well-known idea of Loba Shamayim Hi, which is a similar idea. Loba Shamayim Hi means when the famous case where Rabbi Elezer and Rabbi Yeshua and everyone, they were warring over that oven, is it Mekabel Tumah, is it not Mekabel Tumah, and Rabbi Elezer was adamant that it's Tahor, and he called in for a baskal, a heavenly voice, and Rabbi Yeshua responded, we pay no attention to heavenly voices, lo b'shamayim, he, the Torah is not in heaven, and it's got to be worked out through the Bez Din, through Medrash Halacha, through the mechanism, the methodology of deriving halachas. So lo b'shamayim is quite similar to this idea of Eile HaMitzvos. It bars prophecy from the halachic process and from introducing new mitzvahs. That's Eile HaMitzvos. Now what's interesting is, there is a question that arises regarding this Gemara, and there's room to say that you cannot answer it from the Gemara, but you can still find the answer. To what do I refer? The drasha is on the words Eile HaMitzvos, the concluding words Eile HaMitzvos. The question is, more than one chumash concludes with the words Eile HaMitzvos. Not only does chumash Bamidbar conclude Eile HaMitzvos, but so does Chumash VaYikra. Eila mitzvah, v'ashetzi v'ashem z'oshev, b'nei Yisrael, b'har Sinai. So the shaila is, which eila ha-mitzvahs is the subject of this drasha? Now, and once again, you can't tell from the Gemara, because the Gemara just quotes eila ha-mitzvahs, but it's exactly the same word. There are later commentators who will supply the references and the sources, but that itself is subject for discussion. Well, reason would dictate that the eila ha-mitzvahs that the Gemara discusses is the end of Bamidbar, for the simple reason that if you're going to say that this is it and there's no more after this, so you'd want it to be the later the better, because the earlier it is, there's more even in the Chumash. Now, it's true that even after Bamidbar, you still have Devarim, but that gets into the question of Chumash Devarim, how exactly it works, Mishneh Torah. But certainly, if I had to choose, if I'm going to say this is the final point for mitzvahs to come in, is it going to be the later point or the earlier point? It's obviously going to be the later point, which means that left to our own understanding, we would be inclined to conclude that the Eilei HaMitzvahs that the Gemara is talking about is the end of Chumash Bamidbar. However, it can be demonstrated that this is not the case. How so? I mean, the Gemara just says Eilei HaMitzvahs. But we need to remind ourselves that in addition to the Gemara, which has its discussions of mitzvahs, its drashos of psukim in the Chumash, there are other works on the Chumashim themselves, which are accompany the Chumashim and give the relevant drashos. When we talk about Medrash, important, as we've mentioned this in the past, but certainly colloquially, whenever you hear the idea of a Medrash, it will always be something thematic or homiletic or whatever it may be. That's a certain type of Medrash. It's one branch called Medrash Agada. That's Agadic Medrash. So insights into the lives of the Avos and Moshe Rabbeinu, etc. That's like Medrash Rabbah and Medrash Tanchuma. Those are Medrash Agada. But there is another branch of Medrash called Medrash Halacha. And Medrash Halacha is what we call Darshanim the Halacha, that is to say, the methodology of deriving the Halacha. That's a halachic business. And then for something of a colloquialism, we normally, as soon as we hear Medrash, we assume it's going to be one type of Medrash. But and what are the collections of Medrash Halacha? That's the Michilta, which Rashi begins to quote in Chumash Shemos. Because the Mechilta is the halachic medrash, the collection of halachic medrash of Shemos. The Taras Kohanim is the halachic medrash on Vayikra. And the Sifrei is the halachic medrash on Bamidbar and Devarim. So just to have in terms of the to map out when we see these ideas and these sources quoted, they are all medrash, but some are medrash halacha, some is medrash hagada. How does this relate to us? Because if you look in the Taras Kohanim, in the very end of Vachumash Vayikra, you will find the drasha of Eila HaMitzvos. But if you look in the Sifrei, in the end of Chumash Bamidbar, there is no mention of any such drasha, Eila HaMitzvos. And that's why it's very interesting how it's exactly the same drasha as the Gemara says, but it gets a time stamp, or Chumash stamp, location-wise, from the Medrash Halacha, because if the Medrash Halacha of Vayikra mentions it at the end and not of Bamidbar, you know that the phrase that Chazal were referring to was the one at the end of Vayikra. But having established that, which is itself very important, of course it begs the question, but why? As if to say, there'll be a later Eilei HaMitzvos. Why isn't the later one the more all-encompassing one? It would stand to reason. But here, the Pardes Yosef explains that if you look at the Ramban's introduction to Chumash Bamidbar, we know Ramban has brief introductions to the Chumashim, the Ramban characterizes Chumash Bamidbar, and it is a general characterization, that the mitzvahs in Bamidbar are mitzvos l'sha'ah. They are mitzvos for a specific time. What are examples of the mitzvos l'sha'ah, the way they're to be counted, the way they're to camp around the Mishkan, the way they're to travel, and so on and so forth. Many of the ongoing commands in Chumash Bamidbar are mitzvos l'shah. There is no question that there are also permanent mitzvos in Bamidbar. There are quite a few, duchening and nazir and sotan and so on and so forth. But what characterizes the Chumash in general is mitzvos l'shah. Well, says Pardes Yosef, if the contents generally of Chumash Bamidbar are of a certain, relate to a certain time, but are not ongoing in nature, so you understand why there is no drasha at the end of Bamidbar saying Eila HaMitzvahs, that a Navi cannot do this, because it happens to be that a Navi can. A Navi has the authority to suspend or introduce something on a temporary basis for just cause. It's called Haras Shah, a contingency ruling. A Navi can do that. What's a classic example of a Haras Shah by a Navi? Eliyahu b'Har HaKarmel, which was the Haftarah not long ago. Actually, we had Eliyahu, and not, but it's for Kisisa, in fact. And what happened there? So we focus on what was achieved there. And there were miracles there, and that really is what's emphasized. And so be it. But for Eliyahu to do what he did also involved a temporary suspension of a Torah prohibition. How so? Because the Beis HaMikdash was yet in existence and function. This is during the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. The halacha states that when the Beis HaMikdash is in function, then it is forbidden to offer korbanos outside of the Beis HaMikdash on a private altar, which is known as bomos. That whole episode in Har HaKarmel involved bomo, and Eliyahu suspended it. And the reason why is because he is, as a Navi, has the authority to do that for just cause. I mean, he needed to confront Navi HaBaal, set things straight, and deal with whatever needed to be dealt with. Interestingly, but it's a fascinating point, as Reuven Margolius points out, In the Sefer Margolios Hayam on the Seches Sanhedrin, just to see how the greats learned the psukim of the Chumash and of the Neviim. The pasuk there is in Malachim Aleph Perek Yudches. It describes the whole thing, and they have their confrontation, and you choose the cow, and you offer up the do what you want, and see if I can come out. And he's taunting them, and he's whatever. Eliyahu is mentioned numerous times throughout the perek, not surprisingly. And what is he called throughout the perek? Eliyahu, also not surprising. But just before he offers his korban, Vayhi balos ha-mincha, mincha time comes. Vayigash Eliyahu Hanavi. For the first time in that perek, it calls him by his full title, Eliyahu Hanavi. The shaila is, this has got to be the 10th time he's mentioned in the perek. He's been a Navi for a while now. How come it only gets mentioned at this particular stage, says the Reuven Margolius? Because until now it doesn't make a difference whether he's a Navi. But now it does, because he's about to do something that can only be done on the authority of a Navi, namely to offer a korban outside the Beis HaMikdash on a private altar. You've got to be a Navi. And therefore, he approaches as Navi in order to do that. So that is Haras Shah. And therefore, if Bamidbar is generally comprised of temporary mitzvah, so to speak, mitzvahs for a certain time, Haras Shah. So you can't say that Eila Mitzvahs bars a Navi from that, because he can also issue a Haras Shah. That's why it's specifically, we go back, it's the earlier pasuk, but it's the more relevant pasuk to what we're talking about, because the final pasuk of Chumash Vayikra is not about temporary mitzvahs, but all the mitzvahs in Vayikra are ongoing in nature. Ongoing in nature, a Navi cannot institute that. That remains true. And that's what's behind pulling back the Eila HaMitzvahs to the earlier pasuk of the end of Vayikra, not the later one, at the end of Bamidbar. Just one final comment with regard to Eila HaMitzvahs, just to see the scope. Of course, each of these could become full discussions in themselves, but just one or two of the highlights of this idea. Where else do we see Eila HaMitzvahs that a Navi is not allowed to introduce halachas? The Gemara in Maseches Temura which I think the Daf Yomi is coming up to. They're going faster, these final masechtos. So in Tumur and Daf Tet Zayin Amud Aleph, it states that there were a number of halachas, many halachas, that were lost to the Jewish people upon the passing of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Gemara says there were 3,000 halachas, which is the Gemara's phraseology for a great many halachas. Shloshes halachas, nishtakhu bimei evlo shel Moshe Rabbeinu. Which means people were not only mourning the loss of Moshe Rabbeinu, somehow they lost contact with these halachas and they didn't know what to do. So they came to Yehoshua. Yehoshua's in charge now. And they said to him, Sha'al, inquire. And what does it mean for Yehoshua to inquire? It means he's got to inquire from on high to get these halachas back. And Yehoshua said, no, I can't. Why not? Lo b'shamayim hi, which is again, similar idea. Ei lemitzos, lo b'shamayim. I can't, it's off limits. So what happened in the end? In the end, they got those halachas back, but not through heavenly means. The Gemara says someone else stepped in. Osniel ben Kenas was one of the shoftim. Osniel ben Kenas, hechziran bepilpulo. He had such a mastery of pilpul, and pilpul, the way the Gemara uses it, is the halakhic methodology of deriving and comparing and so on and so forth. He had such a mastery of the body of Torah, he was able to reconstruct and re-infer the correct answers to all of these halachas. And that's Osniel ben Kenas. He's mentioned in the Navi, in Shoftim, as conquering a place called Kiryat Sefer. And part of what that means is that he was able to master the domain of the Sefer. That's how the Gemara explained. Now, why do I mention this Gemara? Because it gives us a further, I think, chiddush, as to the scope of this idea of there's no place for prophecy in halacha. How so? Because these halachas weren't being introduced now. They already existed. They'd become lost. So you're not talking about using prophecy to introduce halacha. You're talking about using prophecy to retrieve halacha, to reclaim halacha. One might have argued, and perhaps that's why the people asked Yehoshua, one might have thought, listen, these halachas have already existed. We're not asking for new information. It was here, but we've lost contact with it. Could you reclaim it? And when you do, it will always have been here, or it was here from the start. And that's why it's quite a chiddush to say that even with regards to halachas that existed here on earth, but if they've been lost, they cannot be reclaimed through nevuah. It's pilpul or nothing. So that's quite an important point. And I mention it because, and with this we'll conclude, there is a Gemara elsewhere which seems to imply just the opposite. There is a mitzvah called Arava. Arava, what we have a zecher for in Hoshana Rabbah, where we do hakafas with an Arava, but in the Beis Hamikdash, it was done, they did that hakafa every day. And it's from the Torah. Every day. What we do on Hoshana Rabbah is zecher for that hakafa. Okay. The Gemara in Sukkah, Daf Mem Dalet, Ahmed Aleph, discusses Arava. I may have spoken too soon when I say where it came from. We'll follow the Gemara. The Gemara cites a teaching that this is an institution of the Nevi'im. Yesod Nevi'im. Okay, now we know. Where does it come from? The Navi. The Navi can introduce halacha, just not Torah halacha, halacha d'oraisa. The Navi can introduce halacha d'rabbanan. Nevi'im can also be rabbis. So it's from the Rabbanan. But the Gemara says, really? We have a tradition that the Arava is an oral Masorah tradition from Moshe. Halacha la Moshe Misinai. How can you say it's from the Navi? So where does it come from? From Moshe from Sinai? From Hashem to Moshe to Sinai? Or from the Nevi'im? Says the Gemara, it's from Sinai, but they forgot it. How could they forget it? Because they were in Golos for 70 years. They forgot a lot of things. Well, while they were in Golos Bavel, they forgot it, and the Nevi'im brought it back. Okay, how did the Nevi'im bring it back? It says Rashi, two words which sent the Torah world reeling. Al pi hadibur, they got it back through prophecy, the Nevi'im. And now we have a problem. because with regards to the halachas that were forgotten in the passing of Moshe, they existed, they were forgotten, and then when they asked Yoshua, use Nevuah to get it back, he said, I can't use Nevuah. Even to retrieve halachas, you can't use Nevuah. But that's exactly what happened, according to Rashi, with Arava. It existed, it was forgotten, and it was retrieved through Nevuah. So can you use prophecy to retrieve a halacha that's been lost? Or can you not? That is the question. Temura says no, Sukkah says yes. But how do we reconcile the two? Says, again, Pardes Yosef, one of the greats of Poland there, Rabbi Yosef Potanowski, it really depends. Because didn't we see that with regards to those halachas, those halachic rulings, Yeshua wasn't allowed to get them back. But they weren't irretrievably lost. You just need to find the right person. He'll bring them back. Through what? Pilpul. Mastery of halachic methodology. He knows what to compare to what, how to get the answer, how to derive it, how to draw it out, etc. So as long as Pilpul is there as an option, Nevuah is not an option. And all those 300 halachas, they were Pilpul friendly. They could be brought back through Pilpul. And therefore, Nevuah was out of bounds. But you know, it's a case that Nevuah can bring back halacha if there's no way in the world that you could get it back through Pilpul. What's an example of such a thing? Something where it's an independent tradition from Sinai. It's not like anything else. It's not a halacha of mutter or asr. To what will you compare it? You have no basis. You have no traction. There's no context. And therefore, had it not been brought back through Nevuah, it would be impossible to bring it back through Pilpul. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not prepared for it to be lost. And therefore, when Pilpul is not an option, Nevuah becomes an option. And that's what happened with Arava. So, we've seen, perhaps one could say through journeys of our own, Parshas Maaseh is not often looked upon as one of the parshas where that much discussion is generated. But as we often realize, and always, in fact, that's a question of how much we're prepared to look. We see through our discussions, matters of Machshava, Holchei Drachim, Ovrei Drachim, matters of Lashon HaKodesh, the first syllable, the last syllable, even Parshanut, Esam, before and after, and to matters of Halacha, finally, Nevuah, with regards to the Halacha, and plenty more to say, Mitzvah Hashem, we'll leave for another time. In the meanwhile, Chazak, Chazak, Benes Chazik.